Learning in today's world. Welchen Impact haben die gesellschaftlichen und technologischen Veränderungen auf das Lernen und die Beziehungsgestaltung im Unterricht? Jetzt im Resonanzraum Bildung, ein Podcast der PR Zürich. Ein Gespräch auf Englisch mit John Hattie und Janet Clinton. Moderation Wiltrud Weidinger.
Welcome to a new episode of our podcast Resonanzraum Bildung from the Zurich University of Teacher Education. The title of this afternoon's session is Learning in Today's World in an increasingly digital, performance-oriented and fast-paced environment. I'm very delighted to warmly welcome two international guests to our studio, educational researchers John Hattie and Janet Clinton. John Hattie, by evaluating over 2,000 meta-studies, he discovered over 400 factors that influence learning success. John Hattie is a professor of education and an educational researcher at the University of Melbourne. His work has had a worldwide lasting impact on effective teaching, the roles of teachers and the importance of feedback. Janet Clinton is a professor at the University of Melbourne and leads the Teacher Effectiveness Research Hub. She has worked on many international evaluation projects and generates research evidence to improve teaching and staff development in schools. We're indeed very delighted that you are both here in Switzerland today. So welcome again to our podcast. Now, John and Janet, you're both experts in learning and you have recently been traveling around Switzerland. Is there anything that you have learned personally since arriving in Switzerland?
Well, firstly, thank you for having us as part of this podcast. We love talking about this topic, as I'm sure you do too, Willie, so thank you. Look, we haven't been here that long, so we have to be very careful. We've only visited two schools. Okay. And I'm sure they were picked because they were very good, because they were very good. Mm-hmm. The first school was in a school where it was a mix of hard of hearing, deaf, mm-hmm. and regular students. And if you hadn't have told me, mm-hmm. sitting in that class, I probably couldn't have told you which was which. Mm-hmm. The way they interacted together, the way they worked together, the way they struggled together was really quite impressive. Mm-hmm. And the second school had been using some of Wolfgang Berrell's work in visible learning. He's based here in Switzerland. And the bottom line was when you walked around that school as we did, unlike most places we go, we saw less teachers teaching and we heard kids learning. Mm-hmm. And that was just a pleasure to hear that. Of course you need both. And mm-hmm. it's the fact that the teachers created mm-hmm. that learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. But having done our homework, we have a lot to learn the rest of the world about how you do vocational education mm-hmm. at the high school level. That's mm-hmm. very impressive, that we struggle with dramatically. Mm-hmm. I do know about the way in which you still have a tracking system, which I cannot understand how you can afford so much wasted talent mm-hmm. by doing those kind of notions. I also know that, like Australia, you have a canton system yes. where there's a lot of independence across the cantons, mm-hmm. same situation in Australia. Mm-hmm. But what Australia's done over the last 15 years is done a lot more working together across mm-hmm. cantons to mm-hmm. reduce the inefficiencies, which are dramatic mm-hmm. when you have independence, while still allowing mm-hmm. for some independence within the system. Mm-hmm. And I do worry, like Australia, that here in Switzerland, I struggle to see a really good career pathway for teachers to stay in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. an act of faith at the moment, it's an act mm-hmm. of love. Mm-hmm. And in our changing world, where it's going to be harder and harder to find teachers and teachers are going to start their careers in our profession much, much later. Mm-hmm. Australia, it's already 33, 34 when they first start teaching. Mm-hmm. We're in trouble if we don't have a really good career structure for teachers to stay in classrooms mm-hmm. and also to have leadership. Mm-hmm. So overall, we've learned a lot mm-hmm. From our 2 days, but we've got a lot more to learn.
Yeah, that's a very good attitude, being open to learning. What about you, Janet? Yeah. I mean, you have done so many evaluations. You have seen probably a lot of different things also around the world, I suppose. What was your impression?
I think, in fact, if I start thinking about the students, because mm-hmm. John's already talked about the couple of classrooms that we've seen. The one thing that struck me was how not just happy, mm-hmm. but comfortable mm-hmm. these students were mm-hmm. in their classroom. Mm-hmm. One of the things that was really interesting is they were actually talking to one another mm-hmm. about the work that they mm-hmm. were doing and happily providing feedback mm-hmm. on how things were going. Mm-hmm. like John, I'm not a favour of the tracking system or the levels, and we did have some good discussions. But what was interesting is in one class, students were choosing where they were and really comfortable to say, no, I can't do that. I need to go here before I go there and there. That was quite amazing. Adults have real problem with that. It's almost like evaluative thinking and thinking aloud, and that was truly magnificent to see. Teachers, there were two things. They were really comfortable with their students, just talking just like we are, and that was really great. I was surprised at the lack of discussion, and I think this relates to what John is saying, about the steps that teachers may go through. So in many OECD countries, there's professional standards that teachers, and I think they're pretty much the same. In the Australian context, we have them so that they're mapped to a career progression. There was no discussion about those standards being mapped to a career progression, which tells me that, you know, the development of your professional identity and the pathway he talked about might be difficult. There was one other thing that shocked me, and this was yesterday. We were talking to people about leadership, and despite we did a bit of homework thinking about leadership, we realised that up until 20 years ago, which for me is not that long ago, there was no concept of a principal in a school. And so the classroom itself was totally autonomous. And I was like, how? How did that happen? And what made the change? And then, of course, the next question I had was, so what difference did it make? And nobody could tell me what difference it made, because in all the work that I've done, leadership is critical. Any innovation, any change you bring in, it really relies on strong leadership. We don't have that. So I was surprised that we haven't had that kind of historical look and then the evaluation of the change. No leadership to leadership. What has that done to the system?
Maybe a very typical Swiss element, these schools that only became schools led by professionals not such a long time ago. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for these impressions. You have mentioned a buzzword, or you have done, John and Janet as well, autonomy of learners, autonomy also of teachers, and atmosphere and culture. And you also advocate this in all your work, John, the importance of classroom climate and atmosphere. Making decisions, being able to make decisions, being able to decide where you want to work, where you want to start, and so on. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more why classroom climate is such an important factor from your point of view?
Well, firstly, I have very little time for the concept of autonomy. I don't think my airline pilot has autonomy to do as he or she wishes. I don't think my plumber has autonomy to do as he or she wishes. I would want to speak more in terms of duties and responsibilities. And I think this is really interesting given the change over the last decade that teachers, one of their duties, I would argue, is to work together in critique, in evaluative thinking, to improve the lives of all kids. And all students in the school belong to all teachers, not to my class. But then I take the view about the critical nature of classroom climate, and I start from the premise that a fundamental role of the principal and the school leadership is the quality of climate and class culture in every class and across the school. We can't wait. And what I mean by that culture in classroom is that this place you come to is a learning organisation where learning is valued and is precious. We know that teacher-student relationships are very critical, but we sometimes forget that teachers need to build student-to-student relationships because students sometimes can be quite unpleasant to their fellow students, particularly when they don't know. And that's probably the key point. The whole point of those relationships is so that it's safe to fail. It's safe to not know. And that's what we ask school leaders to do when they do walkthroughs through classrooms. What happens when a kid makes an error? Is it an opportunity to learn or is it an embarrassment? Like my five-year-old granddaughter, I had the luxury of picking her up on first day of school because mum and dad are both teachers. So I picked her up got in the car. I said, how was it? And she said, it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. She said, oh, my gosh, it's great. Mm-hmm. I said, what was the best thing about the day? Mm-hmm. Lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Really good. And then after the bubble started to slow down, I noticed the car went very, very quiet. And I said, Emma, what are you thinking? Mm-hmm. And she said, I hate school. I said, tell me more. She said, I can't read. And I said, being smarter than the average five-year-old, but Emma, if you could read, there's no point going to school. Mm-hmm. Oh, she says. Mm-hmm. But being smarter than the average granddad, she said, does that mean when I learn to read, I don't have to go back? She learned on day one to compare herself, and because she couldn't do something, she was a failure. And that is absolutely the opposite mm-hmm. of the climate we need. And so when we talk about those relationships, we've got to remember the why. The why. No kid comes to school, in any school in Switzerland, to learn that which they know. Mm-hmm. And therein lies the problem with student choice. When we ask students to make choice, they choose that which they can already do. Mm-hmm. And the novice doesn't know what they don't know. They don't know what they don't know. That's why we have teachers. Mm-hmm. That's why I argue it's the teachers, mm-hmm. not the student, not the AI, mm-hmm. that has to choose the success criteria. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be successful? What is the quality of being successful? Mm-hmm. And their job is to work with the students. So we use the metaphor that our job is to teach students to drive their learning. And the same way you drive a car, mm-hmm. the skills, you've got to take account of the environment. Mm-hmm. There's different speeds, there's different on-ramps, there's different exits. Mm-hmm. And the teacher's job is to set the destination and help the student, mm-hmm. no matter which direction they take, mm-hmm. to get there. Mm-hmm. And there is a time when you teach a child to drive where you get out of the car and let them. Now, if that's autonomy, I'm with it. Mm-hmm. But autonomy is often interpreted as student choice, mm-hmm. leave the kid to work by themselves. It's like personalisation and individualisation. The concept's right. Mm-hmm. But what we do is we say, the child's going to work alone. Mm-hmm. No, they have to learn to work with others. Mm-hmm. They have to learn to seek help. Mm-hmm. So this is where that classroom climate is very mm-hmm. powerful. It's very easy to measure. It's very easy to see. And it's without it, it's very tough to have progress to achievement. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Now, Janet, you also investigated into these environmental factors of classroom practice. Can you tell us a little bit more about specific good practice measures for an environment as John has described, or for an effective, also in the view of the teacher's perspective?
I think I have to go back to where John started mm-hmm. with the notion of autonomy. Mm-hmm. And if you think about autonomy, you know, people think it means you can do whatever you like. Well, one of the things that's really important in terms of teacher practice is they do feel that they have some autonomy in their space. There's been several evaluations that have looked at autonomy. And if you just go, you can do what you want, it does not work, which is where I think John is sort of going. But you wouldn't want to take that notion that the practice of you have autonomy with guardrails that are set by the standards that we have, by our curriculum, by, you know, appropriate behaviour, etc. So I think that's an important one. And again, if you're going to think about how would you know whether your teacher is, it's not just in control, but in control, has a real understanding uh-huh. of their environment and is making moves to adapt mm-hmm. their lessons as they go, mm-hmm. that's really critical mm-hmm. to see that happening. And for me, that's an element of autonomy, mm-hmm. that you're comfortable enough to say, this is what this environment needs. So you have, and again, the notion of belonging, mm-hmm. the notion of adaptation, quality delivery, mm-hmm. all of those things are really important. If we think about the measures notion, what do we do? Currently, you'll see leadership going in through classrooms, doing their walkthroughs. There are systematic measures that you can look at environment, things like class, which has been around for many years. Technology is allowing us to see how teachers are teaching.
So different ways of getting
different
also
ways.
Data.
So if you think about the school community, you're going to have principals, you're going to have parents, you're going to have other teachers coming in the room. You're going to have standard measures. And what they're really focusing on is what are the students saying. Mm-hmm. In a standard classroom, a teacher can use a simple exit ticket to see what the kids are feeling and thinking. So there's many ways. Mm-hmm. I would probably argue that all of those things teachers need to be comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You want to invite people in. Principal, what am I doing? How can I make it better? Yeah. Feedback from parents, feedback
from colleagues,
that whole collective efficacy, most critical thing. Understanding what the students feeling, thinking is critical. Mm-hmm. And that's embedded in what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's standard. And if they don't do it, mm-hmm. they're not asking, their students shouldn't be in the classroom at all.
Mm-hmm. We have an app that we've been using, and there's many out there, where the teacher stops the class at any particular point and says to the students, go on the app, identify how you're feeling right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we have many hundreds of thousands who have done it around the world. Mm-hmm. The dominant feeling throughout the world, mm-hmm. without shadow of doubt, is boredom. Mm-hmm. And boredom is the absence of challenge. Mm-hmm. And the good news is when you show the teachers the results, they fix it. Mm-hmm. The problem is they often don't see it. Mm-hmm. And kids learn very quickly, by age 7 or 8, how to look engaged when nothing's happening. And so I think this is where, you know, measures some of we have now, all these apps we have, really can help teachers understand how kids are feeling and thinking and what that culture was like through their eyes.
Maybe also improve their own competences of self-reflection and of, you know, adaptability.
The critical thing here in all of these is I'm going to make a gross generalisation and say 50% of our teachers in Australia, in Switzerland, in the UK, in the US, you name it, don't like those apps, do not want people in their classroom, and certainly don't want anybody watching them. And we, as John has said, we for about 7 years used a visible classroom app, and the whole point was the teachers would record, not film, but would record what they were saying and allow the students to see their words on an iPad. Those teachers that love to engage in partnership, collaboration, loved that the kids could see what they were saying, could use it in many ways. Those teachers that were closed and not interested in feedback hated the app. We had teachers that would say, I'm not starting it until the students are settled, because nobody wants to hear or see me telling Simon over there to sit down.
Yeah.
And I was bemused by those kind of comments, because what kind of environment are you doing if that's that kind of teaching?
So
there's an issue with that kind of feedback evaluation.
But there's also a question of mindset of teachers, no? I mean, we do have the engaged teachers who like apps like this, teachers who would voluntarily come to the in-service training courses here at our university, who would be open for any kind of new or interesting course or module. But we also have the other part, teachers who are very skeptical, who doubt things, who are reluctant to try out things. Now, how do we bring these teachers on board? This is our very good, crucial question. And I don't know if you have any advice on this or how you do this in Australia.
Well, firstly, it was only about 2 years ago, for a reason, that I was asked to prepare something on teacher self-concept. And what stunned me, there's virtually no research ever. And so it's coming to your point. And so we've worked at lots of different ways of looking at teacher self-concept. And some teachers are improvers. Mm-hmm. They'll do anything they can to improve. Some are maintainers. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it for 10 years. I've got my system. It works for me. Mm-hmm. Everything will fit in. I don't need all this other stuff coming in. It's just extraneous. I'm not going to go to professional learning because you're going to change me. I don't need to change. It's okay. Now, I'm not saying either is good or bad, but it is getting to your point, is that we do have a profession that we have too many that are reluctant to see improvement. On the other hand, we do have a profession which is very good at denying its expertise. And like when you give an example of a child making remarkable progress, the teacher often says, oh, the kid did it, or the parent did it, or the resources did it, or the time David did it. No, it was them. Mm-hmm. Then when you say it's not working so well, they can get very defensive on it. So we have to open that up. I like the medical notion of the second opinion. We need that in education amongst our teachers. Mm-hmm. I've lost your question.
Mm-hmm. How we bring them on board, the skeptical ones.
The logic that we promote is Janet's notion of evaluative thinking is we want improvers mm-hmm. in our school profession. And our argument is that, firstly, I think every single teacher who ever came into education came in for one reason, to have an impact on kids. Mm-hmm. So let's remind them on that. Mm-hmm. And then the second is, if you look at all the learning theories, particularly the gaming learning theories, is that people are motivated to do something when they improve. Motivation follows improvement, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily precede it. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a real pressure on leadership mm-hmm. and professional learning to make mm-hmm. sure there is improvement. Like, we can't blame the teachers here. Some teachers are very wise. Mm-hmm. They go to professional learning, they learn tips and tricks, mm-hmm. waste of time. And we know that professional learning is quite variable. But professional learning that works actually improves you. Mm-hmm. Now, that requires me, if I'm your leader or your coach, to firstly understand how you think, understand what motivates you, understand your theory of teaching, understand your theory of learning. And my job is to help you work out what is the problem here that we're going to fix. Whereas what we often do is we come in with a solution and say, you're going to use my solution. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're very good at problem defining. Mm-hmm. Now, the evaluative thinking teacher, the one that really makes the difference, they are incredibly good. They are so nosy, to use mm-hmm. Janet's words. I'm stealing her words here. Mm-hmm. So nosy to find out, Willie, what is it you're struggling with here now? Mm-hmm. Is it because you haven't got the basic knowledge, or is it because you don't understand the question, or is it because you made a mistake in step three and are now in step five, etc.? They're very nosy and they really want to come in yeah. because their motivation is, I want to help you improve. Whereas others, I've read the script, you do the task, you hand it in, I grade you. So I think it does come back, but I want to put pressure on the professional learning people. Like, I like the Singapore model. Every teacher in Singapore is assigned a coach, mm-hmm. not necessarily in the same school. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the year, if the teacher doesn't make their progression, mm-hmm. the coach is fired, as it should be.
Yeah.
They laugh when I say that. They say, no, we don't actually fire them. We bring them in for retraining, and sometimes we give them other jobs.
Of course. Okay.
We fire them.
Okay, kind of relief. Yeah. Okay.
And I think that's a really good model we should look at. So let's be careful. It's not just the teacher here.
So basically, if I understand you correctly, it's more about also bringing teachers into a mood, maybe, or a perspective of asking questions.
Yes.
Of investigating,
practice,
becoming curious again.
Absolutely.
Reminding them of the
why
profession.
Why is it so and why is it not so? That's the core evaluative question. Yeah. Like, research asks, so what? Mm-hmm. Evaluation is, why is it so? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we want to teach. And that's what we want in our kids.
Mm-hmm. There is a couple of wonderful pieces of evidence mm-hmm. out there. They're a bit damning. Mm-hmm. It's called bifurcated system. Mm-hmm. And very simply, it says that there's two systems that run in education in most countries. Mm-hmm. And it's the system that this is what you should do, this is what it is, I'm going to tell you what we should do, now we want you to do it. And the teacher goes into their classroom and closes their door. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking about the history of leadership in Switzerland, it's a perfect example. So the answer is, you've got to open the door. And you have to go back to the climate where we started in terms of our discussion. If there's a trusting climate, if there's a climate of growth, enhancement and learning, the organisational learning is so critical. And if a teacher is comfortable within that climate and is comfortable in maybe making a mistake, and then saying to the students, this is not working. Yeah. Let's do something different. Yeah. Creating that climate is really, really critical. Mm-hmm. And I would argue what we've done over time in many of our countries, and Australia included, is really focused on the knowledge and the skill. And this is true in not just our curriculum areas, but wellbeing, mental health, same thing. We want you to know all this stuff. We want you to be able to have the skill of imparting it. And what we've forgotten right from initial teacher education is that self, which is where John started. And we know that there are really key components. And working with our teachers to feel comfortable to engage in those key components of self, it is self-concept, but it's also that self-reflection, that self-awareness. It is that self-efficacy. And it's okay not to feel confident doing something, because then you've got collective efficacy. You've got that to bring in. Resilience. And their own sense of, think about well-being for teaching and learning. from a teacher's perspective. So all of those contribute to their readiness to engage in all the things that people say they must do. But we don't talk about those things. Sadly, in our teacher evaluation programs, whether it's a performance development, we have people that do actually rate them based on their, you're not very confident, you know, you have no self-efficacy. And while I'm, you know, a trained psychologist, I feel comfortable making some assessment of that. I'm fairly sure that principals and other teachers aren't and shouldn't. So it's a real dilemma. These self factors, these contribute to effective teaching, decisions that are made, they contribute to retention, and they contribute to a teacher's readiness to engage in all the activities they need to do with students. So in John's language, it's all about their effectiveness, and we ignore them in professional learning. We don't go there enough.
And we see a phenomenon here in Switzerland that teachers also seem to be overwhelmed under pressure with delivering the contents, trying to reach learning goals with their students as they have to, according to curricula, and at the same time dealing with a lot of heterogeneous groups in terms of linguistic, in terms of cultural, in terms of even religious or other dimensions of difference. So what would you recommend to teachers who do feel this pressure of not succeeding and who have no power left for engaging into, I don't know, a professional learning program or any other kind of training or any other process? I mean, we do have a lot of schools also who started to go into a kind of system learn, a peer system of like establishing teacher leaders, for example, expert teachers who could be pioneers and bring their team on board. How can we solve this problem of teachers that are under pressure and that have no power left?
I firstly acknowledge that you're right, that feeling is out there. But I want to turn it on its head. I saw yesterday two schools where I saw stunning interactions of incredibly variable classrooms, quite a lot of pressure, the curriculum, as you say, is large and whatever, and they did it. I think we can learn a lot from those that are already doing it under this, or we can blame the outside pressure, but how come those teachers can do it? They have the same curriculum, they have the same time, they have the same kind of kids, and they do it. And one of the things is to look at how efficient they are, to look at their coping strategies. And certainly in my own life as being a head of a university department for 20 plus years, is what you not do. In our jargon, we call it de-implementation. How do we stop doing things? And I don't think there's enough time and motion studies. And I'd encourage schools and teachers who think that way to get a time and motion person to watch them for a week. There's an amazing amount of things that we do that we don't need to. No one asks us to, but we've done because we've always done, and they don't have any effect. Like in our studies, 90%+ of what a teacher and a principal does, they choose to do themselves. But we blame the compliance. We blame the curriculum. And so this is a mindset change I want to make. I'm not saying that teachers aren't given an incredible job to do. They are. Every problem in Swiss society, schools will fix it. We know that happens. And sometimes I think we have to say no to some of those. But coming back, I want to work with teachers to make them more efficient in what they do. I want them to stop. Like one example with one school we worked with where there were three teachers in one room with 90 kids. One teacher did all the preparation for one semester, one third of the year, and the other two didn't. Their job was to come to school and teach. On the condition, they didn't tell anyone else because too many people think a busy teacher is a good teacher, an efficient teacher. We can get weighed down with all those crises you say, and you never mentioned the incredible amount of kids coming into Switzerland without English as a first language or even a background. You haven't added so many other things we could add. The one thing I'd love to do, and I say this to every minister I meet, wouldn't it be nice, minister, to set up a curriculum review where the instructions are take half out? Your kids don't need as much. But every curriculum review adds more and more. I think that's something that we can seriously, seriously fix. But overall, I want to study those teachers, and there's never been a school in the world yet that we've gone into where we haven't found a group of them that are doing it incredibly well, love their job, very efficient, acknowledge these problems, but have the coping strategies to deal with it.
If you step back and look at it, we need system change, which is what John is hinting about. If you look at models of well-being generally and how you improve well-being, and we've taken some of those and had a look at how they might support teachers in this place. You've got to take a systems thinking point of view. It's kind of going through that whole ecosystem. So what kinds of professional learning, resources for professional learning, can systems provide? Then how can a principal know their school, know the culture, know who is really struggling with, let's say, resilience, or being able to say how they're feeling in the classroom, a little anxious about things? The leadership in the school needs to understand that climate and then provide targeted professional learning in that space. It's precision based. It's targeted to the needs of the teachers. Now, the teacher has a responsibility for self-development. Professional learning alone, where people aren't engaged and they're just listening, you might like it. Sounds nice, but doesn't mean you're going to do it. So that implementation step requires the right program, the right leadership to promote it and championing it, and then engagement. And then a backup to say, how'd that go in your classroom? Right. And that evaluative cycle is critical. And what we've found in the work we've done looking at those key dispositions that teachers need that predict their behaviour and their intention to behave, and things like acceptance of difference in the classroom, right? That surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, resilience, self-awareness, social desirability, and self-concept all predict how they're going to behave. So you've really got to take those things into account and then provide resources to assist in that coping strategy, problem solving and emotional solving. Those things are critical. It's got to be done together. One group can't do it. Teachers can't do it alone. Principals can't do it alone. The system has to be there and has to be resourced.
Yeah, so it's like a whole school approach.
It has to be.
Perspective also, and also the courage for de-implementation, which is sometimes maybe difficult to take.
I think the biggest problem in schools is the lack of courage.
Yeah. I do have to touch another topic with you. Coming from Australia, I do have to ask about the role of social media, digital technology, artificial intelligence, now that Australia has passed this regulation for social media, for children, your young people under the age of 16 who are no longer allowed to have a social media account. And we all know about concentration spans and cognitive abilities and how children can keep focused on tasks. What is your opinion about this? Do you think that this will be effective, or do we already know whether it is effective?
I think the major issue, and John points to this regularly, is that there have been no guardrails around social media. So something had to be done.
Right.
And we were a bit late. From a learning point of view, it concerns me that we are taking technology away from our students. We are not giving them, developing those skills that they will need. So imagine being 16 and not being engaged in some form of social media, not being able to cope with the flood of information that's coming in there, that the comments about people, etc., and you've had no exposure. So we know from history, prohibition doesn't work. On the other hand, right now, today, something needed to be done. And so what's starting to happen within schools, while there's been a pushback from technology generally, no phones in schools, no iPads in schools. We did see computers the other day, and that was fantastic, the way they were using it. That's a real concern for me. These are digital natives. So we have to commence with really getting people to understand how it should be used, put those guardrails in place. And I think the last thing that's really, really important, and I'm going to argue very strongly and have in Australia and will continue to, is we are not teaching our students to make evaluative judgments about the quality of the information that's in front of them. And unless we do that, we are going to have a serious problem. You are not going to stop the flood of information.
And so basically critical thinking.
Even with bookending it. So it is, because you've got to make a judgment about your own opinions. And then you've got to reset and think, well, have I got enough evidence to do that? Peer assessment is kind of making evaluative judgment. And we saw that in the classroom the other day. That is critical. Half of our teachers don't do it either. So we've really got to work with our teachers to model that with our students. And that's really all tied up with technology, AI, social media.
Well, we have different views on this. Janet was talking there about use of technology in the classroom, and no one's taking that away. It's the use of social media apps.
Like cell phones.
And I agree that we didn't have the discussion 10 years ago and we're paying an enormous price. The bullying, the misuse is huge and it crosses the boundaries of school and home. And I can't think of a single thing that a teacher would want to do that requires the use of an iPhone in the classroom that they couldn't use an iPad or a computer for. So I'm in favour of banning phones. It will need a reset as we go through. This was well heralded about a year before it happened, so there was plenty of activity. It was resisted, as you know, by the software companies dramatically, but they solved it. It started in December, which in Australia is the end of the school year. So the question is, what happens over January and February, and what happens when they come back? And when they came back, it was astonishing. For example, there was a study in the media this past week where a school measured the noise in the playground last year, and the noise in the playground this year has gone up by a factor of 11. That's dramatic. And the whole notion. Now, we ban kids driving cars. We ban them from going to pubs and alcohol. We ban them from lots of smoking, whatever. And, of course, there are kids who get around it. And one of the biggest problems we've found is that the parents who then allow their children to use their social media account to perpetuate the problems we had before. Of course, there's going to be that. But overall, many schools had already banned phones in schools very effectively.
Even before.
Absolutely. And so that was not a surprise to many. And very few will actually go back on that. But here's the problem. Are we going to wait 10 years to have the same guardrail discussion about AI? We better move fast, because that's got much more invidious and nasty implications if we get it wrong.
The question here, or the discussion, was always revolving or also around the issue of, if we ban cell phones, then we also ban cooperation or interaction between students, between people, because it's not they don't spend their break times being alone on their cell phone. A lot of the times, students, there are two or three who, I don't know, have some kind of conversation. So it's a dilemma.
And it is, and there's going to be a few lonely people out there now because of what you've said. But this is where schools are responsible for the climate and culture in the school. Before cell phones, we always took the view of how you do mix up kids. Like, we're not a dating service, so we're not asking kids to be friends, but you are asking the classroom for them to learn how to respect themselves and respect others. You are asking them, like all our employers have been asking for the last 30 years, for graduates who can work in teams, who can translate and communicate. And if we don't do that in our classrooms, we're not making our students employable. So I hear what you're saying, but I think that puts more responsibility on us to do what we should be doing for the last 20 years, dealing with that.
It is an issue for a core group, and that core group, students that require additional needs, neurodiversity. So we're actually cutting off a way of communicating. The truth be told, I don't support total bans of anything, because it doesn't really work. We needed to do something, and I suspect that what we've done will set the guardrails up, and then it'll balance out. But I do have real concerns for our students who have additional needs in mainstream schools, because technology, AI, social media, all of those things have a wonderful impact for people who are just quiet. But I can do it this way. Think about the gamers. They have great friends online. I don't know how many older people had engaged with Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how you sort of reconnect mm-hmm. with people. Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be the same for our students, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's Facebook yeah. or whatever it is in the future.
Right.
So, yeah, I have some concerns about
that. Yeah,
maybe
also the differentiation, as you have pointed out before, between digital technology in a teaching situation in comparison to social media on cell phones and so on. We have so many questions for you prepared. I'm so afraid that the time is running out, but I do have a very central question that addresses the students here at our university who will become future teachers. Now, if you could give an advice or some kind of maybe professional hint to what kind of a mindset they have to adopt, what the most important competences for future teachers are, what would you say to them? What would you like to give Swiss students who will become primary, secondary or kindergarten teachers as an advice?
So we know through a tremendous evidence base what relates to a successful mm-hmm. teacher in the classroom. And we can demonstrate there's some key characteristics that will predict your classroom readiness down the line. So obviously the knowledge, mm-hmm. have to build the skills, really important. Again, I'm going to go back to those mm-hmm. key characteristics. So acceptance of difference, mm-hmm. social skills, the ability to communicate, mm-hmm. the psychosocial skills, those are essential. Mm-hmm. Building self-efficacy, building resilience. Interestingly, physical health and well-being play an important part, which I never would have predicted, because we sometimes have teachers that aren't particularly happy in their own life, mm-hmm. yet they come into the classroom and they blossom and burst, right. and it's a place of happiness for yeah. them. But there's no doubt that sense of self-care is really critical. Their motivation, which will predict readiness. Mm-hmm. So what you've got to think about is the motivation to teach. Why do you want to do it? Your self-characteristics, these capabilities mm-hmm. to self-reflect, to think evaluatively, mm-hmm. to understand that continual learning. Mm-hmm. They're key. Mm-hmm. And as teacher educators, mm-hmm. it is our job to ensure that we are building all of those, mm-hmm. and we don't. And particularly at the moment, given teacher shortages mm-hmm. and the issues of workload and all of those things, we are missing dealing with the actual problem because we're just loading them with more things and not giving them the opportunity to think about what they need mm-hmm. to cope. And then the idea that when they go into the classroom, they're totally classroom ready, which is not quite true, because they've generally, in most countries, they have a year or two to catch up. Mm-hmm. But what about that induction? And what happens in that place? There's a period where we must have the cognitive skills. Mm-hmm. I will never, ever deny that. I need them to know stuff. Mm-hmm. I need them to be able to do things. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, I need them to understand themselves mm-hmm. so that they can think evaluatively mm-hmm. about the situation they're in, mm-hmm. their impact, and how they're feeling.
So, and it would be the role of our universities to take up this role as the coach or the guy who sits next to you in the car while you are driving.
Yes.
I think the students who come to us have had 15, 20,000 hours of being a student. And our job is to have them look through the eyes of a teacher to understand what it looks like to be learners mm-hmm. in front of them. They're no longer a learner in front of the teacher, they're the teacher in front of the learner. And so we have a chance. We know at the moment from the meta-analysis, the effect size of initial teacher education is tiny. And that's a problem, because we do deal with their worry about classroom management, their content skills, and we should worry about those things. But the one big thing that we often forget is how they think about what they do. And so when we had the program at the University of Melbourne, every assignment was the same five questions. And these are the five questions that I want everyone to think about becoming a teacher. What's the problem here? And working out the problem with an individual student or a group of kids or a class is really a skill. Because what we often do is we come in with a solution and hope it fits the problem. And that's initial teacher education students, they want a lesson plan. What if the kids already know it? Like 40 to 50% of everything taught in every class the kids know already. No wonder they're bored. So what's the problem? What's the evidence-based intervention you're going to use to address the problem? How did you go about implementing it? What worked? What didn't? Because in the real world, it doesn't always work. What was the impact in terms of what was taught well and what wasn't taught well? Who was taught well? Who wasn't taught well? It wasn't progress. And what are you going to do next? And we wanted them to think this way as they went into their math class or their physics class, or they had a naughty student or they had an interaction with a parent or whatever. And this evaluative thinking that Janet is writing the book about, spending a lifetime looking at this notion, is what we need to do from day one in our initial teacher education. And quite frankly, we don't. We fill them up with tips and tricks. We put them out there and hope like hang that they don't fall over. And I just think that's not good enough. There is a way of thinking. There's a way of... And the irony is that we ask, particularly in our high schools, our math teachers want kids to think like a mathematician. Historians want to think like an historian. We need to think like a teacher. How do I maximize my impact?
Thank you very much for these final important words, the statements. We have to think like a teacher. Janet and John, I would like to thank you very much for being here, for taking the time, for going into the conversation here. And I wish you all the best for your remaining days here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sie hörten Resonanzraum Bildung, ein Podcast der PR Zürich. Diskutiert haben John Hattie und Janet Clinton. Moderation Wiltrud Weidinger.